Hey everyone, you're listening to Bionic Bug Podcast with fiction author and national security expert Natasha Bajima. Join me as I discuss the latest news about emerging technology, read chapters from Bionic Bug, and explore the real-life technologies featured in my novel. We'll discuss where fiction meets reality in the future. Hey everyone, welcome back to Bionic Bug Podcast. You are listening to episode number 29. This is your host, Natasha Bajima, fiction author, futurist, national security expert. I'm recording this episode on November 4, 2018. Last week, I was at the United Nations in New York City, where I spoke about the digitization of biology at a side event of the UN Security Council Committee on Resolution 1540. The event was hosted by the Bolivian and Swedish missions. I'm happy to say that my remarks were well received. It was thrilling to be a speaker in the same room where I was once a junior staffer taking notes. I've included some pictures in my show notes if you're interested. Also, Project Gecko is now available both in paperback and ebook. You can purchase the paperback on Amazon. The ebook version is currently only available from Kobo, although if you want it for your Kindle, you can just email me a copy of the receipt and I'll send you the Mobi file. I'll include the links in my show notes if you're interested. Also, you might be interested to know that this month I am participating in NaNoWriMo, which stands for National Novel Writing Month. This is a challenge in which hundreds of thousands of novel writers attempt to write a 50,000 words in 1 month. Sometimes that's an entire novel, although mine are longer. I am writing Genomic Data, the third novel in the Laura Kingsley series, and hope to finish it by the end of the month. Okay, let's talk tech. My first headline for this week is slightly heavier than a toothpick, the first wireless insect-size robot takes flight, published on CNBC.com on November 2. Engineers from the University of Washington have managed to fly the first wireless insect-sized robot. This work has been going on for some time. The key challenge has always been the weight of the power source. These engineers created the RoboFly. I think I've talked about this one before. It's a robo insect powered by an invisible laser beam that is pointed at a photovoltaic cell, which is a solar cell, attached on top of the robot. And this cell converts the laser light into enough electricity to operate its wings. The engineers were able to design a circuit to boost the power in the solar cell to power the robot's wings, and also a microcontroller that acts as its brain. The RoboFly can now only take off and land, but they are working on a way to steer the robot. They expect such robots to be fully autonomous within 5 years. Of course, if you've been listening to me read Bionic Bug, you know why I like the story. Robot insects have been constrained by the weight of the power source and electronics. Live insects are self-powered. The work to control the flight of insects has advanced far more quickly, has been underway since the 2000s. But it's a really interesting development here because I'd imagine that robotics are far more cheap and easy to do. Insects have limited lifespans and sometimes only by a few weeks. So my second headline is, Can We Predict When and Where a Crime Will Take Place? Published on BBC.com on October 30. Cops in the UK are using algorithms and big data to predict where and when crimes will occur, and adjusting their policing accordingly. This idea, of course, is that crime prediction leads to crime prevention. Sound familiar? In Minority Report, a short story written by Philip K. Dick in 1956, features a set of precogs who are able to see and predict all crime before it occurs, eliminating crime in a future society. Instead of being arrested for crimes that are committed, they're arrested and tried for pre-crimes based solely on the logical progression of their thoughts. Of course, what the British cops are doing is very, very far from this. And there's also a historical precedent for these types of practices. In the past, police would use what they called hotspot analysis, which is based on past crime patterns to determine where to post officers. Predictive tools offer a way to show where crime will take place based on a wide range of factors, but there are a lot of questions these systems raise. What about bias? Crime patterns tend to take place in certain communities, and some have alleged that the system has learned racism and bias from the data, leading to increased policing in areas where with high crime rates, and of course, self-fulfilling prophecies. I guess time will tell on this. Let's turn to Bionic Bug. Last week, we learned Lara's fate from her beetle bites and put the pieces together on Fiddler's plot. Let's find out what happens next. Chapter 29, The Remote. While Rob and the detective searched high and low for signs of Ashton and Anita around DC, Lara had spent the past 2 days lazing around her apartment, weak and suffering from bouts of fever and chills. Maggie said the flu-like symptoms were normal and to be expected given the large number of beetle bites. Even so, her friend called every few hours to check on her. Not wanting all of her leads to run cold, Lara decided it was time to search Sully's townhouse for the remote box, even if she felt like death warmed over. Her body ached as she drove across town on her bike, but the crisp fall air refreshed her. After a 30-minute ride, she pulled her motorcycle into the alley behind Sully's townhouse and parked next to the gate. She'd been so consumed with figuring out what Fiddler was up to with the Beatles that she'd completely dropped the ball in solving Sully's murder. I need to find that box. During the interrogation, Ashton mentioned that Sully had purchased a remote from Cybershop over the dark web, and the package was delivered by mail to the townhouse. Maybe the box had a return address, or better yet, a clue to Cybershop's identity. Lara desperately needed to solve the case. She couldn't afford to keep working it for free. Since her arrest, Sanchez tolerated her collaboration, but had not offered to pay the usual consulting fee. She worried Vic might quit if she couldn't pay him soon. So far, every lead on Fiddler's location had come to a dead end. The same went for Sully's killer. Rob's call to the State Department about the passport revealed that Fiddler held two passports, one under his own name and another under Henrik Spielman, his father's name, with Fiddler's picture, of course. Both were associated with the address of his old house, and neither passport contained a stamp for Australia. How did he get the beetle? Did he have a third passport? Rob had stopped by the Tacoma Park neighborhood library with a warrant to check if Fiddler still had an active library card. Unfortunately, Fiddler's account was linked to the same address he used for everything. The same one kept coming over and over. Another dead end. Rob would have to establish probable cause for a full top-to-bottom search of the commercial complex. And thus far, they had come up with nada. Shivering, she pulled her leather jacket tightly around her to keep warm. She entered the back door, her nose wrinkling at the stench from the garbage still strewn all over the place. Sully's next of kin had not yet tended to his townhouse. Perhaps no living relatives had been identified, or his property had gotten tied up in probate. She bit her lip as she surveyed the mess. She'd always connected with Sully over their shared orphan status, but right now, it felt sadder than before. Is this what will happen to my stuff when I'm gone? It'll all rot away or be taken away by a bank or something. Lara sighed and began sifting through the trash and recycling remnants, looking for any evidence of a cardboard box belonging to the remote. After inspecting every box and mailer on the ground, she was convinced Sully had not put the package in the trash. No, that would be too easy. Wiping her hands with a partially used paper towel, she marched toward the townhouse. This time, the back door to Sully's townhouse was locked. I should never have given the keys to Detective Sanchez. She thought about calling him, but wasn't in the mood for his usual hassles. If they found nothing, the detective would grumble at her for wasting his time. If she struck gold, he'd be angry it wasn't his idea. It was lose-lose. She tried the key attached to the Yoda keychain, but it didn't fit. She examined the windows, but they were all secured from the inside. Damn. Fortunately, she'd picked locks on occasion. It was a natural talent. Lara took out a lockpick from her coat pocket and began fiddling with the lock. The lock disengaged within a few minutes, and she opened the door. She stepped into Sully's kitchen, which remained in complete disarray. The smell of rotting food had grown more putrid since her last visit. At the dirty sink, Lara washed the grime off her hands and considered possible hiding places for the box. Sully, where would you put something you wanted to keep hidden? The logical place for unpacking the remote would have been Sully's safe room, but he had emptied it before he died. After searching through his dining room, the library, and a living room, Lara finally went upstairs to check out his third floor bedroom. It felt weird going through his personal belongings. The top shelf in Sully's closet was stacked with old shoeboxes. Lara began opening them one by one, looking inside and throwing the empty boxes in a pile on the floor. She found nothing interesting except that her dead friend had a penchant for expensive footwear. Frustrated, Lara sat down on his bed. The floor creaked underneath the added weight. Floorboard, Sully? You were old school. As she stood up, the hardwood floor squeaked underneath her feet. Lara got on her hands and knees and rolled back the huge Persian rug. Knocking on each floorboard, she listened for a hollow sound. Toward the center of the room, Lara found a floorboard smaller than the rest. When she pressed down on one end, the other lifted up. Just like that. Lara removed the floorboard. Something was hidden in the hole. Adrenaline surged through her veins and her heart started to race. Reaching under the floorboard into the hole, she felt a cardboard box and pulled it out. Perfect size box for the remote. Sully's home address was on the outside of the box. The return address was the post office box. Maybe the P.O. box is associated with Cybershop's physical address. Of course, the post office wouldn't just give Lara that information, but Justine had already proved she could pull some strings by flashing her government badge. Lara opened the flaps. Inside, she found pictures of a familiar black BMW convertible with Maryland license plates parked in front of the neighborhood post office. 19024K. The plate doesn't match Linda's. Could it be the plate for Stepanoff's car? Lara flipped through the other pictures. Several were of Linda Maxwell entering and leaving the post office. Was Linda driving Stepanoff's car to visit her P.O. box? On the back of one of the pictures, Sully had scribbled the BMW plate number with an address. Laurel Lakes Apartment Complex, Apartment 302, 248 Miramont Drive, Laurel, Maryland, 20707. Sully had already done much of the legwork. It looked as though he had gotten a physical address for an item purchased through secret online channels. Vic is right. The dark web is overrated. Like everyone else, black market dealers depended on postal systems or couriers to send their physical wares to their customers. Physical items could be tracked as they moved from sender to recipient. Law enforcement authorities could conduct surveillance, seize packages, and investigate who they were being sent to or where they were coming from. Lara shoved the picture in her back pocket. This might be what the intruder was looking for on the night of Sully's murder. Something else caught her eye. Reaching into the hole in the floor, she pulled out Sully's passport, a thick wad of $100 bills, and a business card for Space Saver Self-Storage. She turned the card over in her hand to find a three-digit number written on the back. Unit 506? Is that where you moved your files? Would the Yoda key open the storage unit? Lara smiled to herself. Finally, she had some decent leads. She took out her phone and called Rob for backup to check out the apartment at the address. The call went to voicemail, so she hung up. If he wasn't available, she could visit the storage space on her own instead. After all, Sully meant for her to find the Yoda keychain. Stashing the cash in her pocket, Lara put the box back into the hiding place, replaced the floorboard, and rolled the carpet back into place. Back on the main floor, she paused for a moment in the library and stared at the shelves that hid the entrance to Sully's safe room. It wouldn't hurt to look one more time, would it? Just in case I missed something? Lara lifted the book, pressed the button underneath, and waited as the shelves creaked and moved slowly outward, revealing the secret door and electronic keypad. She entered the code from memory and stepped back, expecting the door lock to release. Instead, a loud beeping sound pierced the air. Startled, Lara stepped back, wringing her hands. Someone must have deactivated the code. The security company will be alerted. Oh my God, I have to get out of here. The safe room door squealed open. Terrified, Lara froze in place. Inside, a familiar curly brown hair and cocky grin waited just beyond it. Lara let out a breath. She held in. Rob, what the hell are you doing here? The blood drained from her face as the thought crossed her mind. Did he see me search the place? I'd ask the same of you, Lara. I guess this is payback? Rob looked handsome in his brown leather jacket and ripped blue jeans. Ha! Lara smiled uneasily. Did you trigger the alarm to scare me? Rob nodded. And I just disabled it. Don't want the security company showing up and finding us here. That could be awkward with Sanchez, if you know what I mean. Yes, I do, Lara grimaced. You're on the clock? Rob shook his head. My boss wanted me to check out the townhouse one more time, and I was in the neighborhood on a personal errand. It looks like you found something interesting. He pointed to the box in her hand. How did you know I was in it here? Lara peeked into the safe room. The room was completely empty. Even the computer and the video screens were gone. Lara breathed a sigh of relief. She'd forgotten the DC police had been there and removed any remaining evidence. So Rob hadn't seen her take the cash after all. I saw you pick the back door lock and hid myself in the safe room, he smirked at her. Oh, Lara said. Are you going to arrest me for breaking in? I might, his eyes twinkled. So what's in the box? Lara opened the box and handed him the pictures. An apartment address, pictures of Linda at the post office, and a post office box address, and a picture of a black BMW convertible with a Maryland license plate. And it doesn't appear to be Linda's. Wow, you really won the lottery. Rob stared at the picture and turned it over in his hands to inspect the address. We'll run the license plate through our databases, but it looks familiar. If I recall correctly, this one belongs to Stepanov. Detective Sanchez looked it up a while back. Of course. I might have also found the place where Sally hid his case files. He left a business card for a storage company and the key to his unit. Well, that's convenient, Rob stood, grinning in the doorway, blocking her entry. Let me in, please, Lara demanded. I want to get another look in the safe room. He waved a hand at her. The safe room is clean, Lara. I've searched it from top to bottom. But please, be my guest, if you think you can do better. Lara shrugged her shoulders. I don't doubt you searched everywhere, but I would feel better if I checked it out one more time. Go for it. Rob shot a fake, irritated look, moved aside, bowing at the waist and motioning for her to enter. Lara rolled her eyes as she walked past him into the storage room with the bunk beds. She got down on her hands and knees. Lying on the floor, she squeezed herself under the bottom bunk bed, feeling under the mattress and along the back wall. How's it going down there? Rob asked. Find anything? Are you stuck? She pulled herself back out, got to her feet, making sure to give Rob a proper glare. Rob grinned. I already told you, there's nothing there. No need to get yourself covered in dust. She moved back into the office. Rob followed closely on her heels like a stray dog. Turning around, she shot an exasperated glance at him. Do you mind? Grinning, he stepped back to give her some space. Lara opened the drawers of the filing cabinets and scanned each one again. Empty. Checking one more time, she slid her hands under the bottom of each drawer. Ha! Rob loitered behind her, trying to see over her arm. What ha? Under the bottom of the top drawer, she felt a large envelope. How did I miss this last time? She stood on her toes. There's something here, but I can't get to it. Rob reached over her shoulder and slid the envelope from underneath the drawer. Lara could smell his cologne wafting under her nose and feel the heat of his body close to hers. Her skin flushed and then tingled, and her heartbeat throbbed in her ears. The sound of a loud thump and squeal pulled her out of her temporary distraction. Startled, they both turned to see the safe room door close with a heavy thud. Did you accidentally close the safe room door? Lara asked. No. Rob ran over to the electronic panel and entered his code to open the door. On the other side of the door, Lara thought she heard something shatter, followed by heavy footsteps. She looked over at the blank wall where the screens once hung and wished she could see what was happening. The code isn't working, Rob said, punching in numbers. You're punching it in wrong. Hurry, before we're locked in. Rob tried two more times, but failed each time. The panel beeped at him angrily. Several seconds later, a series of heavy snaps and clicks sounded as the lock engaged. The bookshelves began screeching as they hid the safe room door. Holy shit. We're locked in here. Her eyes were wide. What the hell happened? Sitting on the cement floor, they waited for Rob's team of FBI agents outside the safe room to break them out and restore airflow. Someone had smashed the electronic keypad and cut the wires, complicating the effort to open the door. I should call Vic. Lara took out her phone. No, my guys had this. Rob stared at his phone, impatient for an update on their progress. Lara sighed heavily. They've been at this for several hours and the temperature is rising fast. Both Rob and Lara had shed their leather jackets and were sweating through their clothes. Whoever had locked them in had also they disabled the safe room air intake system. Sally had installed a pressurized ventilation system as protection against a biological attack. The irony was not lost on Lara. The contents of the large manila envelope from the filing cabinet lay on the floor between them. It contained a police file on the car accident on the Chesapeake Bay Bridge that killed Anita's husband, Frank Moore, and their son, Jaden Moore. Lara flipped through the pages in the thin file, reading the document summaries. "The police didn't think it was an accident," Lara said to Rob. "The detective on the case claimed it was a homicide made to look like an accident." "Based on what evidence?" Rob asked, fiddling with his phone. "The speed and angle of the car, plus Anita claims a car driving on the wrong side of the road of the bridge forced Frank to hit the railing. She thought it was a dark-colored BMW, but only saw it a few seconds before her car went over the side of the bridge." "But they never identified the driver?" Rob asked. "No, the accident took place on a dark, rainy night. That part of the bridge was covered by surveillance cameras, but when the cops checked the videotapes, they found footage of Frank's car driving over the bridge, but nothing else. The tapes were static at the time of the impact. The same for those pointed in the opposite direction." In other words, the camera either wasn't working properly or someone tampered with the footage. Lara nodded. "And of course, Anita couldn't recall the plate number of the oncoming vehicle. The case finally closed a few months ago, determined to be an accident." Rob crinkled his forehead. "I'm thinking Sully wouldn't have kept the file well hidden if he agreed with that finding." "Sully definitely had kept it secret for a reason," Lara said. "What if Cybershop was in the other car, trying to kill Frank?" Rob ran his fingers through his hair. "Didn't Fiddler's son-in-law work at NSA at the time of his death?" Lara nodded. "So Fiddler assumes Cybershop is a double agent, working for the government and selling top-secret encryption technology over the dark web. Maybe Frank found out about it, and Cybershop killed him to keep silent?" "Sounds like a plausible theory to me." "But who is this Cybershop character?" Rob asked. "Any information in the file?" Shaking her head, she stuck her hand in the manila envelope to check that they'd found everything, and pulled out a few papers stuck to the bottom. "What is that?" Rob asked. Lara scanned the documents quickly. "Holy shit, this might change everything." "What?" Rob gaped at her expectantly. "Anita and Frank's bank records for the past 2 years showing a regular influx of some major cash. Way more than they'd earn monthly between the two of them." "Can you tell where the transfers are from?" Lara shook her head. "There's also an internal brief from the NSA listing the suspect's sales of advanced defense technology over the dark web." "So now do you think Anita is guilty?" Rob asked. A growing sense of unease made Lara squirm. "I'm just not as convinced of Frank's innocence. Maybe Stepanoff was his accomplice, and Linda laundered the money for them. That could explain the transfers before and after Frank's death." "Sounds plausible, but don't you think Anita would know about it? The money is in their shared account." "Is Detective Sanchez right? Do I have a blind spot where Anita is concerned?" She was silent for several minutes and wiped the sweat from her brow. "Can you have one of your guys run the plates for the BMW from the picture while we're stuck in here?" "Good idea." Rob called one of his team members on his cell and switched the audio to speaker. "Hey, you guys close to getting us out of here? This is Agent Carter. We're trying our best, boss. The wiring is restored, but the system's encryption is rather sophisticated." Rob rolled his eyes at Lara. Lara glared at him. "What? I'm good at my job, and Vic is a kick-ass programmer." She was proud of the foolproof system she'd installed for Sully. "It might take some time yet, boss. Best to sit tight for now." Rob grimaced. "I've got a license plate and an address I'd like to run through the databases. Do you mind?" "Sure, boss. Give it to me." Rob gave Agent Carter the license plate and address. "Got it. I'll let you know if we get any hits." Lara's stomach growled loudly. "Was that you?" Rob grinned at her. "Yep, I didn't plan on spending all day in here, so I didn't eat breakfast." Lara looked at her watch. They'd been locked in the safe room for 3 hours now. "So what should we do while we're waiting in here?" Rob's eyes twinkled playfully. "Don't you have a girlfriend?" Lara looked at him sternly. "You don't think I meant, don't play coy with me. You know what you meant." Lara glowered at him. She didn't like being toyed with. Rob opened his mouth to say something and then hesitated. He sat silent after several attempts. "Maybe I made a mistake." "What mistake?" Lara stared down at the file on the floor, shuffling through the papers, wondering what Rob thought he missed. No, I think we've covered everything here. I'm not talking about the case. I meant with Alexa, Rob muttered. Lara gave him an incredulous stare. You think you made a mistake? She enunciated every word, unable to believe what she was hearing. You're calling what you did to me a mistake? You cheated on me. You betrayed our trust. You broke my heart and practically ruined my life. Lara picked herself up from the floor and paced in a tight circle, her fists clenched. A mistake? Tears formed in her eyes. She turned her face so Rob couldn't see. He didn't deserve to see the pain he'd caused her. Lara, please. When she turned, Rob looked up at her with pleading eyes. I was a complete idiot. Her eyes blazed with rage. An idiot? Okay, pig-headed, stupid, cheating, bastard, asshole. Is that what you want to hear? She threw her hands up in the air. I didn't ask for this. For what? Lara's heart pounded so hard it felt like it would come up through her throat. She turned to glare at him. For any of it. Don't you get it? I never wanted to see you again, let alone work with you on a case. And I certainly didn't want you to bring up your cheating while we're here locked in this fucking safe room. You haven't changed a bit, have you? Always thinking about yourself first. Do you think this has been easy for me? Do you actually think I want to talk about this right now? Lara, I'm sorry. Rob rubbed the back of his neck and looked down and away. You know what? I'm finished with this conversation. I don't want to hear any more about your fucking mistakes. Lara leaned against the wall, sliding down the cool cement and sinking into the corner onto the floor. They sat together in silence for another hour before Lara stood up, shook her head in frustration. Your guys are never getting us out of here. I'm calling Vic.
Thanks for listening to the Bionic Bug Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a review on iTunes. You can also support my time in producing the show with Patreon at www.patreon.com. That's Patreon/Natasha Bajma. See you next week.